with the Parsha of Mishpatim, we move from Matan Torah as a general enterprise to the specific realms of Mishpatim. And indeed, the Torah introduces Ve'ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifnehem, Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. And it's interesting to ponder, as many Meforshim do, the implications of the final words, Asher Tasim Lifnehem, that you shall place before them. Presumably, whatever the Mishpatim are, they are the Mishpatim to be placed before them. The Pasuk could have simply said, Ve'ela Mishpatim, and we're good to go. But it adds the words, Asher Tasim Lifnehem, that you shall place before them. And perhaps one of the messages here is based on an observation that is made by numerous Meforshim, that we have a concept of din, that is to say, Beis Din Shalmata, our Beis Din dispenses justice, and Beis Din Shalmala, likewise, has a system of din, of justice. Are they the same? In principle, yes. In application, not always. And one of the specific differences is that very often when someone is deserving of punishment, it doesn't necessarily mean that all those who may be affected in a secondary way are equally deserving. If someone has stolen and the halacha is, the psak is, he has to pay back. In so doing, he may become impoverished, and that may influence or affect the situation of his family. About that we say, as much as the mitzvah of tzedakah, which is a separate thing, but ein ledayan elamasha ein avros, the dayan has to punish the perpetrator, even though there may be others who will also be affected. There's no other way to configure things, no other way to calculate and assess the situation. When it comes to Beis Din Shalmala, however, of course HaKadosh Baruch Hu is capable of calculating all of these things. So the way the din works is that it is judged or be affected by it. And sometimes that can make a difference, whereby even if the person himself is deserving to be punished, but in his situation there are those around him who do not deserve to have the secondary effects, that can also mitigate and make a difference. The Pasuk says in Tehillim, Mishpatei Hashem emes tzadku yachtov. Hashem's mishpatim are truth, tzadku yachtov. The righteousness is collective. It takes everything into account. Yachtov. It occurred to me that perhaps with this we may explain an episode that is recounted in the beginning of the fifth perek of Maseches Brachos that relates to Chana and Shmuel. It's a very interesting Mesorah, whereby Shmuel actually got into serious trouble very early on. His mother Chana brought him to the Mishkan, and Eli is there, and Shmuel, a young boy at that time, he assesses the way things are being run in the Mishkan, and he knows the halacha, and he actually begins to instruct people that they're not doing things right. And he's brought to Eli HaKohen, and Eli says, your psak halacha is correct, but you violated a very serious infraction, which is called Mora Halacha Bifnei Rabo. Issuing a Piske Halacha in the presence of the Rav. The Rav is Eli. The Halacha states, Mora Halacha Bifnei Rabo Chayav Misa. So his career was potentially about to end very quickly, because Eli was going to put him to death. But Chana is still there. Chana intercedes. And she comes and says to Eli, Anochi ha'isha ha'nitzeves imecha bazeh, remember me, I was there that time, and this is my child. As if to say, is there anything that can be done? So Eli says to her, this child, this boy is chayav misa, but he can be replaced. You daven for one, I'll daven and you'll have another child. And then Chana says, I don't want another child. El hanar hazeh hispalalti. I daven for this one, not for another one. And with that, she had Shmuel released from that sentence that was hanging over him. So the Gemara is something of a pele on many levels, actually, how the whole situation. But specifically, where do we ever find that a mother can come in and say, I daven so hard, and therefore he should be released? Justice is blind. Chayev is chayev. How can Chana come in and try and soften things up in the way that she did? And she succeeded. Except I believe the point is, based on the above, namely, when we say that Mor Halacha Bifnei Rabo is Chayev Misa, that very severe response, Chayev Misa, the truth is that he's really Chayev Misa Bidei Shamayim. It's not one of the Chiyuvei Misas Bezdin. It's not like a person who violates Shabbos or murders or something like that. It's really Misa Bidei Shamayim. In fact, the real question, I believe, which I've not seen many Meforshim deal with, is how it is that Eli sought to put him to death, as if to say, even if it's true that he's violated and it was wrong and Mor Halacha Bifnei Rabo is Chayev Misa, he's Chayev Misa Bidei Shamayim. If his liability is Bidei Shamayim, Shamayim are meant to take care of it. Bezdin Shalmata aren't meant to take care of things that a person is Chayev Bidei Shamayim. That should be left for Dinei Shamayim. So the actual question, I think, begins, was about to take action here. What's Eli? Why is Eli getting involved? He's the head of the Bezdin, shall we say, Shalmata. But this is a Bezdin Shalmala issue. But be that as it may, he was. But nonetheless, once we appreciate that Shmuel's liability was in the realms of Bezdin Shalmala, Misa Bidei Shamayim, so it has to work along the guidelines and the parameters of Bezdin Shalmala. Bezdin Shamala won't punish a person unless those around them also deserve to have that experience. And therefore, Chana says to Eli, within the terms and within the realms of his obligation or his liability, even if, let's say, what you're saying is true, that he deserves to be Chayev Misa, but I don't deserve that he should be taken from me. And therefore, the rest of the conversation where Eli says, but, you know, he can be replaced, and what he means to say is, if he can be replaced, then you will not have lost out. To that, Chana says, El Hanar Hazeh Espalalti. He's the one I daven for. He cannot be replaced. Nothing will replace the loss of my son Shmuel, and therefore, I didn't do anything wrong. You can't take the liberty or license to punish him in a way that will affect me, because that's not how Bezdin Shalmala works.
Didn't have much an emotional response, but strictly by the book. In other words, he didn't feel for the
justice is blind. But even by the book, Chana is saying it's a different book, and therefore Shmuel was let off. And perhaps with this in mind, coming back to our opening pasuk, Ve'ele ha'mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. The pasuk emphasizes this is not the be-all and end-all of mishpatim, that is to say, and this is not the only type of mishpatim. Specifically, these are the mishpatim that you shall place before them, indicating that there is another realm of mishpatim that you do not place before them, which takes these broader things into account, namely, as we said, the dinim of Bezdin Shalman. So that's with regards, by way of introduction, the opening pasuk. But I'd like to focus on an aspect of Mishpatim, which is a specific discussion. And as we'll see, there's quite a bit to say in the sources, and there could be implications for a number of interesting situations. At the heart of Mishpatim is the area of Nezikim, of damages, and at the heart of hearts of Nezikim is the damage that a person does personally, that is to say, what damage that he does with his own body or forces. There's many other branches of damage. His animals can do damage. He's responsible for that. He can dig a pit and then someone falls in. He's responsible for that. But damage that he does himself is in a league all of its own. Damage that one does personally is called Adam Hamazik, where the person himself does damage. And the formula for liability there is given in the Mishnah in Bava Kamma in Daf Kaf Vav Amud Aleph, Adam Muad La'olam. A person is always forewarned. A person is always liable. He can never really claim, I couldn't help it, or it was beyond my control, which is an unusual situation. In most areas of Torah, we recognize a concept which is called onus, beyond my control. However, when it comes to Adam HaMazik, a person is held to a higher standard for damage that he does personally, a higher standard, a higher level of liability, and certainly responsibility, and thus we say Adam Muad La'olam. Now, there is a very interesting comment of one of the Rishonim, who's known as the Mordechai, Rabbeinu Mordechai Ashkenazi, and he's a contemporary of the Rosh. They're both Talmidim of the Maharam of Rottenburg, and his halachic rulings, they grace the back of the thing that many volumes have in the Gemara, although they're adding more and more lately. The Gemaras are getting thicker and thicker, but at least in my edition, which may tell you when I bought it, the Mordechai is at the end. And the Mordechai in Maseches Sukkah says the following: Otam Bachurim, those young men, Harochvim Basusim Likras Choson Vekala. So the minhag was that they would go out to meet the Choson and Kala at a wedding in style. They'd be riding their horses, Vinilchamim Ze Imze, and they would also kind of, I guess, joust with each other. They would kind of have like horseback fights. All of this for Simchas Choson and Kala. I mean, it certainly makes for great entertainment. Except sometimes damage can occur. The Korea is big de chaveiro. What happens if one damages the other's clothing? Or mekalkalo, what if he damages the other person's horse? I mean, anything can happen. Shein peturin. There is no liability for that damage, says the Mordechai. Ho'il v'nagu kein machma simchas kosan v'kala. Since it's all in the name of Simchas Choson and Kala, it's all for the sake of the wedding, therefore there's no liability. Now, the simple understanding of what the Mordechai means to say is there are certain circumstances that warrant a bit of flexibility and a bit of license in terms of claiming for damages incurred. It's like a wedding is a liability-free zone. That's the minhag. Now, what's interesting to note, and we're still in the primary sources, and by the way, there's a Tosfos to that effect also in Maseches Sukkah and Daf Mem Hei, but it's important to note that the Mordechai's contemporary, his co-Talmid, with the Maharam Rotenberg, that is the Rosh, argues. The Rosh has a tshuva, and someone asked him this question. In section 101 of Tshuvas HaRosh, someone says they were at a wedding and they were on the horses again, and one of the horses, he sped up and they actually damaged one of the other horses. So he wanted to claim that he is exempt from damages. You know, it's a wedding. And the Rosh rules no such thing. Adam Muad La'olam. If you damage someone's horse, you're chayiv, it doesn't make a difference. You were at a wedding, you were at a whatever. All situations are the same. And therefore we have an interesting situation because it's a machlokas rishonim, Ashkenazi rishonim, Rosh and Mordechai. And the Mordechai gives a certain leeway and says that's the minhag, and the Rosh gives no such leeway. So now the question that we need to ask is, number one, who is the halacha like? It's a very pertinent question, and damage can happen at a wedding. Well, if we're looking for the Ashkenazi psak, we of course turn towards the Ramah. And the Ramah in Choshe Mishpat, in Zimin Shin Ayin Chet, actually paskens like the Mordechai. He rules that damage done at a wedding gets a veto, because that's the minhag, and it's for Simchas Choson and Kala. So he's paskens like the Mordechai. And that's very interesting, because that means that he has paskened, in a sense, lekula, not like the Rosh. That's quite a position to take. And interestingly, and we're not that far away from Purim, this psak has reverberations for Hilchos Purim as well. At the end of Arachayim, Simetafrei Tzadik Hei, Sif Beis, the Ramah quotes essentially an application of this idea, which is found in the Truma Sadeshin, that in the damage that is done within the course of the merriment of Purim, and again, damage can be done on Purim, says the Ramah, no charge. It's based on the Mordechai as well. Purim is basically like a wedding. It's a liability free zone. That's the Ramah. Now, we should know a couple of things. Firstly, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who's watching all of this, and he knows the Mordechai, and he knows the Rosh, and he has an interesting comment to make in the Beis Yosef. And that is, he quotes these Rishonim, the Mordechai, that the Nahagu came, and says the Beis Yosef, Dafke Lididhu, listen, that's for them. By them, he means Ashkenazim. That's for them who, that's the Minhag, so I'm not going to get involved. Aval Lididan, but for us, Asfardim, says Rabbi Yosef Karo, Enevdel, there's no difference between a wedding, not a wedding, Purim, not a wedding, it's all the same. And therefore, the only place that you would see expression for this type of dispensation is in the Ashkenazi poskim. And even there, we should know further that the Mishnah Berurah quotes a certain poskim that you have to know what's called damage, as if to say, listen, there's damage to a person's shoes and there's damage to his car. They're not the same. As if the understanding is that there's a bit of leeway and people are somewhat more easygoing. Somewhat more easygoing is one thing. You broke a mug, that's one thing. You broke a window of someone's house, that might be something else. And therefore, one needs to know how to assess these things. And after all that, we should yet be aware that there are even Ashkenazi poskim, the Aruch HaShulchan, significantly, who says that nowadays that minhag has vanished. And basically, whatever a person damages, they've got to pay for. So that's quite a spread of possibilities, even within the Ashkenazi poskim. But to come back to the Rosh, what's very interesting is the Rosh really represents the Machmirim, if we just keep track of our names and faces, right? The Rosh is the one who says, your horse damaged his horse, it's at a wedding, it doesn't matter, a person's always liable to pay. However, there is another responsa of the Rosh, which is also Paskin in Shulchan Aruch. And the question was, there were two people who were wrestling, and one of them slammed the other one down on the floor and did him a good bit of damage. One could almost say beyond the norm of wrestling. No wrestling. The worst that happens is you get pinned to the ground and then you lose. Okay, so your ego can get bruised, but there are limits. But here, this person sustained more damage than that. Can he claim damages from the person who essentially inflicted this damage on him? And the Rosh rules no. When two people are wrestling with each other and one damages the other, he can't claim compensation for damaging. And the reason why, says the Rosh, is you have to know when you're getting into the ring or the whatever with someone and you're wrestling that will involve force. And moreover, says the Rosh, listen, no one tells you don't have to wrestle. No one told you to do that. But if two people agree to it, they have to know that each one will be using a good amount of force because the goal is to pin the other person down and you'll use whatever force is necessary. Says Rosh, it's not reasonable to demand that the other person, even as he's pinning you down, should do everything that's required to ensure a safe and comfortable landing for you. I mean, he will do whatever it takes in order to pin you down. And sometimes, if things don't land exactly right, whatever, that could result in damage. But you need to know. If we could borrow, I guess, the idiom would really express this very well. Or you're wrestling, or you're not wrestling. You're either in or you're out. There's no wrestling, but then it's almost like smol docha v'yumin mekareves. At the same time, you're trying to defeat him. You're also making sure he's okay. He's not too. It doesn't work that way. and therefore says the Rosh has no liability. So what's very interesting is, let us not forget, this is the same Rosh who said there is no dispensation for damage done at a wedding. You can't say, listen, it's a wedding, things are different here. They're not different here. Whatever person damages, he's liable to pay. And yet, when it came to the wrestling situation, the very same Rosh says, you got to know, wrestling is different. So in a sense, the important question is, and this psak is also paskin by the Shulchan Aruch, which means that's full concurrence of Rabbi Yosef Karo. So what's the difference between a wrestling match and a wedding? Which is stam a good question, but important here. So seemingly the difference is, and it's important to quantify because there could be implications for correct formulation for many other questions. Firstly, says the Rosh, coming back to the wedding, the thing about the wedding is that the one whose horse damaged the other, he was very simply reckless. As if to say, what the Rosh objects to is you can't say it's at a wedding, anything goes. As if to say, you know, I don't need to worry about being vigilant or such like. You do. That's the point of the Rosh. Even at a wedding, the zones don't make a difference. A person is always required to be responsible. So license to damage, you don't have. That's very different from the wrestling situation where whatever excessive damage is done, and here we would add parenthetically, hopefully, unintentionally. That is to say, whatever results in actual damage wasn't something that he was merely being negligent, but rather he did what was expected of him, let's say within that circumstance, and then something happened regardless. That's number one. So one cannot wantonly, or one cannot just permissively indulge in being irresponsible just for the sake of it. Not on Purim and not at a wedding. And secondly, the second important difference is that when it comes to the wrestling match, those that are involved got involved, and they got involved with the understanding that this could happen. In other words, as soon as you enter into a wrestling match, it's with the understanding the person will be applying force. That's what you're there for. And that's quite different, says the Rosh, from a wedding, where we don't say that if you enter a wedding, it's on the understanding that anything could happen to you. I mean, there is no such understanding. People go to a wedding to do mitzvahs and be happy and make the chosan and kala happy. It's not like entering a wrestling match with the almost like the same disclaimer. You don't leave your rights at the door when you enter a wedding in the way that you do when you enter a wrestling match. And perhaps an interesting application of this, maybe some type of a sporting event, a ball game or such like, where sometimes the ball doesn't stay within the field. Sometimes it could be knocked out of the field, and sometimes it could be knocked into a person who's watching, let's say. Now, in terms of pure formal description, the one who hit the ball, which is called Kocho, that's his own force, essentially ended up damaging, breaking someone's glasses or whatever it may be. And now the question would be, is there any liability? It seems, based on our analysis, that all would agree that there is no such liability. And the reason why is because it's much more analogous to the wrestling match, even though the spectators don't come to be involved in the game per se, but they're entering a zone where they must know that anything could happen. Moreover, because it is the nature of these things, that sometimes if the ball gets knocked out a bit further, it could go into the crowd. I mean, that's the sort of thing that could happen. And moreover, once again, it's often difficult to control as he's looking to hit the ball as far as possible that it should go into the aisle or perhaps into the seats where there's no one sitting there. I mean, he can't judge things like that. And therefore, it seems really to have all of the trappings, shall we say, of the wrestling situation, and therefore there would be no liability. You really do you leave your claiming power at the door if you become a spectator with something where something like that could happen. Interestingly, however, there is room to say that actually if he hits the ball even further, completely out of that field into a place where it does damage that no one ever entered anywhere, so it could be that maybe he hit a little bit too far and that person really could claim because he hasn't entered anything and he hasn't disclaimed anything, and that's an interesting Shaila. Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, Shalita, has a similar discussion with regards to a parachuting exhibition, which unfortunately took a bit of a wrong turn because the wind blew and he was unable to control the parachute, and he ended up landing on one of the members of the crowd. And Rabbi Zilberstein says he's Potter, because once again, when you enter, you know something like that could happen, and it's beyond his control. But he makes the similar proviso, as if to say, if the wind blows him so off course that he actually ends up landing on, let's say, a car that's just driving by, or whatever it may be, then he'd actually be Potter. Pardon me, he'd actually be Chayav, because that person is out, completely outside of that zone. He's waived no such rights to claiming. So these are some of the interesting discussions that arise within the area known as Adam HaMazik, what's known as Mazik Birishus. In that way. Interesting to consider further what the implications may be. Now, at the end of Parshas Mishpatim, in Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Yud Beis, we find a Pasuk that has really attracted the attention of many Mefarshim, Rishonim and Acharonim. Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Yud Beis. And the Pasuk reads, and this is Perek Kaf Dalet, which actually becomes more about Matan Torah generally again. Parshas Yisro is about Matan Torah generally, then it funnels into Mishpatim specifically, but Perek Kaf Dalet broadens out again to be about Matan Torah. There's a well-known Machlokus Rashi and Ramban as to whether these events of Perek Kaf Dalet happened Keseder after Parshas Mishpatim, so the woman's like two sessions of Matan Torah, or whether Ein Mukdam U'Mu'ucha BaTorah, and this actually happened before the 6th of Sivan. But be that as it may, the Pasuk read, Perek Kaftala Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayomer Hashem El Moshe, Ale Elai Hahara, Hashem says to Moshe, go up to me from the mountain. This is certainly after, this part is certainly after Matan Torah. It's the beginning of the 40 days where Moshe was there. And I will give you es luchos ha'even, the luchos of stone, the Torah and the mitzvah, asher kasavti lehorosam, that I have written in order to instruct them. So again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if you watch the words carefully to Moshe, that he will give him the luchos and the Torah and the mitzvah that he has written in order to instruct them. And the question that immediately is, if we take the read the pasuk on its simplest level, it sounds like there are three things mentioned here: luchos, Torah, and mitzvah. And it sounds as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu says regarding each of those three things, asher kasavti, that I have written leharosam. And that being the case, it really begets the question, because as far as we know, in terms of what we will read in the Torah, it is only the luchos that were written by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The rest of Torah, the balance of Torah, is actually written by Moshe. It's dictated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but written to Moshe. It is only with reference elsewhere in the Chumash in Parshas Kisisa, we find that the luchos are called Kesuvim Be'etba Elokim, V'hamichtav Michtav Elokim Hu, V'chosavti Al HaLuchos. It's only with regard to the luchos HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that he will be writing. Whereas, with regards to other areas of Torah, we find HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, Ksav Lecha is Kol HaDvarim Eile. You should write. And at the end, of course, Moshe is the one that writes Hazinu and the rest of Torah. That being the case, again, to crystallize the question, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu writes the Luchos only and not the rest of Torah, the rest of Torah is dictated to Moshe, how does he say about Luchos, Torah, and Mitzvah, Asher Kosavti, that I have written? That is the question. And this question is raised by the Ramban. And the Ramban says, therefore, al derech hapshat, if we appreciate the question, we're ready for the answer. Al derech hapshat, we need to understand that actually there are, of the entities mentioned, luchos, Torah and mitzvah, the final words, asher kosavti leharosam, split up. As if to say, asher kosavti refers to some of them, and the harosam refers to the others. Specifically, it first mentions all the things that are available: luchos, Torah, and mitzvah. of those three things, the words Asher Kosavti qualify the Luchos. The word Leharosam qualifies Torah and Mitzvah. As if to say, says Ramban, as if the Pasuk is saying, I will give you Es Luchos Ha'Even Asher Kosavti, La Torah V'HaMitzvah Leharosam. You are the one that writes the Torah and the Mitzvah. And for Ramban, this is an example of what Rav Kuperman came to call the A-B-A-B structure. As if to say, the Torah begins by mentioning A and B, and then qualifying A and B. So you may have four words in a row, but they don't work in succession. One and two are matters A and B, and then three and four go back to qualify A and B. So here too, Luchos and Torah and Mitzvah, and then each one is qualified by a word. Kosavti qualifies Luchos, that's A-A, and Leharosam qualifies Torah and Mitzvah, that's B-B. So that's the Ramban making Seder for us, al derech hapshat. Interestingly, if we look at Rashi, we will see that Rashi comments on the words V'Torah es Luchos Ha'Even, V'Torah V'Mitzvah, Asher Kosavti Leharosam, You should know all of the 613 mitzvahs are included somehow in the Aseres HaDibros. For Rabbeinu Sadia Pirish Ba'Azhoros, and Rabbeinu Sadia Gon actually explained in his, what's called his Azhoros, his formulation, she said, called Dibur V'Dibur Mitzvahs HaTluyos Bo. Rabbeinu Sadia Gon actually wrote a work called the Azhoros, whereby he showed how each of the Aseres HaDibros contains within it and alludes to each of the 613 mitzvahs. Very interesting. Just parenthetically, I'm not sure how many other times, if at all, Peirush of the Torah quotes Rabbeinu Sadia Gon. I'm not certainly offhand. I want to check very easily, but it's one for the books. Rashi says, look at Rabbeinu Sadia Gon, and you'll see the whole thing. But the question is, why is Rashi telling me here this piece of information that all of these 613 mitzvahs are included within Aseres HaDibros? I mean, how is that meant to help me? Is it meant to enhance my knowledge of Aseres HaDibros? Rashi should have said it in Parshas Yisro when we had Aseres HaDibros. But the point is, as Mefarshi Rashi point out, Mizrahi, Kor Aryeh, and basically everyone, that Rashi here is addressing Ramban's question. Because once again, the question is, how can you say about these three things, Asher Kosavti? You wrote the Luchos, but you didn't write the Torah and the Mitzvah. That's for Moshe to write the Torah and the Mitzvah. But how can you mention all three and say Asher Kosavti? And that's why Rashi here says, actually, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did write all three. Because when he wrote the Luchos, and the Luchos contains all three, yes, all 613 mitzvahs are contained within the Luchos. That is why he says Asher Kosavti with reference to everything. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not write the rest of Chumash, but in writing the Luchos, he wrote also the Torah and Mitzvah. That's why Rashi quotes Rav Sadia Gaon here. That's his way of addressing that question. So thus far, one could say, al derech hapshat, we have discussed the syntax, really, of this pasuk. But there is a final comment, which is made by the Ramban. And he says, again, our question is, Moshe wrote the Torah, not, that's to say, transcribed the Torah, not HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as far as we know. So why does Hashem say Asher Kosavti if those words are referring to Luchos and Torah and Mitzvah? Says Ramban, Va'aldas Rabbeinu Yitachen, but based on the way Rabbi Seinu, that is to say Chazal, understand, it could very well be Ki Yihyeh Remes. But there is an illusion here, a quite blatant illusion. Shehaisa Kola Torah Ksuva Lefon of Kodem Shenivra HaOlam, that really, indeed, the entire Torah was written before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before the world was created. Kasher iskarti b'tchila sefer Bereshit, that I've alluded to, or referred to, more correctly mentioned, in the beginning of Bereshit, which is a reference to his introduction to Chumash Bereshit. And there, the Ramban tells us, and makes a reference to the to the concept of the words of Chazal, which say that the world, the Torah was existed before the world in a form known as Eish Shechara al Gabi Eish Levana, black fire on white fire. And therefore, says Ramban, in light of that Masorah from Chazal, so actually when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Asher Kasavti, that is not in conflict with us knowing that it's really Moshe that wrote the Torah, because really what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying is, I've written the Torah already, yes, right? However, I will then, when the time comes, dictate the Torah to you, and then Moshe will be the one who actually writes it down. So according to this final approach of Ramban, it really turns out that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah to Moshe, he gave him Amish the whole Torah. That's really the Asher, I will give you now the Torah that I wrote. I mean, he gave him the whole thing. The problem is, there's a deeper issue with saying that Moshe received the entire Torah at that time. And by Torah, we mean, again, Torah and Mitzvah, meaning not only the Torah and Mitzvahs, but the Torah meaning the text of the Torah. And the deeper issue is, which we referred to actually last week, is that the Torah hasn't happened yet. I mean, the incident that the Torah is talking about have not occurred. Chet HaEgel hasn't happened yet. It's mentioned in the Torah. Chet HaMeraglim hasn't happened yet. It's mentioned in the Torah. Moshe hitting the rock hasn't happened yet. It's mentioned in the Torah. It could cause all manner of disruption, which is another way of saying it's impossible. So actually, as much as we are aware that the Torah exists before, has been written before the world has been created, the last thing that we want to do is for Moshe to read it at this stage. But Ramban is saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him the whole thing. Says the Netziv, to understand what it means that Hashem gave Moshe the Torah, that he wrote it, what we're saying is that he gave him the Torah in the way that he wrote it. And what does that mean? We have referred to that method of writing the Torah, referred to as Eish Shechora al Gabi Eish Levana, black fire on white fire. And actually, this statement of Chazal, or expression of Chazal, is quoted by Rashi in the beginning of Parshas Vezos HaBracha, because in Pasuk Beis, second pasuk of Vezos HaBracha, it says Mimino Eish Dos Lomo, as we know the pasuk very well, Mimino Eish Dos Lomo, from his right hand, so to speak, the law of fire. And what is Eish Dos Lomo? Says Rashi, it means Shahisak Suva Me'az Lefanav. It was already written before Be'Eish Shechora Agabi Eish Levana. But what is this idea of Shechora Agabi Eish Levana? Says Ramban. He said, I've spoken about this earlier in Bereishis. What does he say in his introduction to Bereishis? What Ramban says is that we have a Masorah about the Torah. And that is that the Torah exists in a different form. The very letters of the Torah have a prior form. And that form is actually that they comprise a succession of different names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from Bereishis until Le'enei Kol Yisrael. And that way of writing, which basically, says Ramban, is that there actually are no breaks in between the letters, which means the way to position the breaks between the words, that is to say, the way to position the breaks will give you actually different words than the text that we have of Bereishis. It's the same order of letters, but without being broken up into the words as we have them, they actually exist in their pure form as names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, without reference directly to, not Bereishis, or the history of the world, or the Jewish people, or Tariq Mitzvahs. What happens is, as you then provide the breaks in that series of letters, of those 300,000 plus letters, if you put the breaks in the right way, in the right place, you will get the words that we have of the Chumash. So this is a revelation. The idea, it's at such a completely new dimension, or old dimension more correctly, of the Chumash Shemot that it exists as names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and indeed we refer to this for one of the brachas that we make is the Birchas HaTorah before learning in the morning. And actually the Gemara in Maseches Brachas Daf Kaf Aleph derives a source for Birchas HaTorah from the Pasuk, unusually. What is the source for Birchas HaTorah? Minayin Birchas HaTorah min HaTorah, says the Gemara, as it says, Kishem Hashem Ekra Havu Godel Elokeinu. When I call upon Shem Hashem, or when I call out Shem Hashem, Havu Godel Elokeinu. So you then ascribe greatness to Hashem. And what does that mean? Says the Marsha, it means Kishem Hashem Ekra. When I start learning Torah, that means everybody needs to make Birchas HaTorah. Havu Godel Elokeinu. What's Kishem Hashem Ekra got to do with learning Torah? Kishem Hashem Ekra is one thing. Learning Torah is something else. Says the Marsha, no. Kishem Hashem Ekra is learning Torah. Because when you learn Torah, you are reading names of Hashem. What for you is split up into words of a pasuk is in its prior format, Shem Hashem. And therefore, every act of learning Torah is ultimately Kishem Hashem Ekra. That's the source for Birchas HaTorah. And therefore, says the Netziv in the Hamik Davar, coming back to our situation, when Hashem says, if we understand the pasuk this way, that I will give you the whole Torah, Asher Kasabti, that I wrote, but our problem was, well, you can't give him the whole Torah because he can't be allowed to read it. Asher Kasabti means as I wrote it, in the way that I wrote it. The way that Hashem wrote the Torah in the prior sense was as names of Hashem, but not yet as the psukim and words, etc. That's the way it was given to Moshe. And in fact, what happened then over the course of 40 years was that those very same repository of letters that already had been given to Moshe as Shemus of Hashem then became formatted, so to speak, as the words and psukim of the Chumash. And that was a process of translation, in a sense, from Torah as Shem Hashem to Torah as psukim and words. After each event happened, that's when the breaks came in and it became formatted in that way. So this is a very fascinating way of really appreciating the Chumash that we have in front of us. And in fact, the Netziv elsewhere echoes this idea in his Perish to Shir Ashirim. It's a Perish called Metiv Shir. And the beginning, as we know, Shir Ashirim exists on many levels. The pasuk begins L'reach shmanecha tovim shemen turak shemecha. Pasuk Beis or Gimel of Perek Aleph. L'reach shmanecha tovim, the aroma of your oil. And oil, we know from Chazal, is a reference to Torah. It's one of the things the Torah is compared to. Shemen turak shemecha. What do those words mean? Shemen turak shemecha. Shemen is oil. Shemecha is your name. And turak means emptied out, like from the word rake, to be emptied out. But what does it mean that Shem and Turak Shemecha? Says the Netziv, when we appreciate that originally the form in which the Torah existed was as Shem Hashem, as a succession of Shemos, but then it went from there to become Torah, as to say, the Chumash as we have it. That is a process of emptying out, as if to say it's a process, one could almost say, of decanting from the original repository of Shemecha. Shemen Turak Shemecha, that became poured out and then entered this new container and this new format, which is known as Shemen. So Shemen Turak Shemecha is the process of allocating the letters, which are Shem Hashem, to become the psukim that describe Torah and ultimately describe mitzvahs. It's interesting to note in this regard that the, in a sense, therefore, what we have as the Chumash is an application of what is originally Shemus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, except from our point of view, we might say, well, we've moved from A to B, as if to say we've seemingly left that prior form behind. However, the Radvaz says no. The Radvaz, Rabbi David ben Zamra, in one of his tshuvas, says that it's important to maintain, in a sense, the connection between this form of Torah that we have, the Chumash, and the original form. And the way that it's preserved is the reason for the halacha that a Sefer Torah does not have any vowelization. You got to learn it. You got to know it. But it's never written in the Sefer Torah. And the reason why it's not written in the Sefer Torah, says the Radvaz, is because Torah would fully consign these letters exclusively to the format of the Chumash as we have it. However, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not wish to do that. In order to allow, to maintain for the ability to see them in different formation, more correctly, with the breaks differently, so as not to tie them down, so to speak, to the psukim as we have, even though we have a Masorah exactly how to read each word, but nonetheless, they're not consigned in that way in order to allow them yet to be read in terms of the understanding of Shemos Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's quite a statement from the Radvaz. And perhaps in this regard, although there's much, a great deal to say, but just one final comment, which someone actually told to me on the Simchas Torah, so it was really worth staying in shul all that time. The pasuk in Vezos HaBracha, which refers to the original form, so to speak, of the Torah, Eish Shechura Al Gabi Eish Levana, are the words Eish Das, as we saw from Rashi. Eish Das, the law of fire, and Rashi says it existed before Hashem, Eish Shechura Al Gabi Eish Levana. Okay, there's something very interesting about the words Eish Das, and that is, there's almost like a kriyuksiv, you could say. If you look in the Chumash, you will see that the two words, Eish Das, are written as one word. Eish Das, as one word of four letters. Except we know that they're not to be read that way. They are really to be read as two separate words. But they're not written as two words. They're written as one word. And that's Halo Davarhu. So what are we to make of that? Says the Be'er Yosef, such a wonderful concluding comment here. How appropriate it is that the words Eish Das are written with no break in between them, because these words Eish Das represent the way that Torah was written before the words were split up into words. Beforehand, says Ramban, there were no breaks. Now, of course, we have breaks, otherwise we wouldn't know how to read the Chumash. But nonetheless, it remains the word that represents how it originally was, is written the way it originally was, with no breaks, and therefore Eish Das is written as one word. That's actually still yet a throwback to what Eish Das is really talking about. So these are really some very, very fascinating discussions, and as we see, they begin by the questions of Rishonim and Achronim on Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Yud Beis. And from there, let us conclude by referring to very famous words, which are just a few psukim earlier, Perek Kaf Dalet Pasuk Zayin. And that is, of course, Nase V'Nishma. Pasuk says, Vayikach Sefer HaBris, Moshe took the Sefer HaBris. We need to discuss shortly what that was. But clearly it represents the Bris, the covenant, Bris Torah, Vayikra Ba'aznei Ha'am, Vayomru Kol HaShadibur Hashem, Na'aseh V'Nishma. The words Na'aseh V'Nishma that we're very familiar with are a feature in Parshas Mishpatim, not in Parshas Yisro. In Parshas Yisro, they said Na'aseh. In Parshas Mishpatim, we have Na'aseh V'Nishma. And the question that all Mefarshim are dealing with is, what is the meaning of the words Na'aseh V'Nishma? And the measure of the problem here is that if you take them in a linear sense, it's very difficult to understand what they mean. Na'aseh we will do, Nishma we will hear. Well, what are you going to do before you've heard? So you nothing, because you don't know what to do. Which means it should be Nishma and then Na'aseh, which of course it isn't. But what then is the meaning of Na'aseh V'Nishma? What can you do before you've heard? Well, of the great Pashtanim, the Rashbam, explains very simply that the truth is that certainly if we take the Pambandas, the Jewish people had heard some mitzvahs already. You already have Mishpatim, you already have other preparatory mitzvahs, which means they know some mitzvahs, they just don't know all mitzvahs, but they've heard, they've been given enough to have already experienced receiving mitzvahs. And therefore, says Rashbam, very simply, Na'aseh V'Nishma means the mitzvahs that we've already heard, because there are quite a few of those, Na'aseh we will do, and Nishma we're prepared to hear all the other mitzvahs that we haven't heard yet, which is mamish, a very straightforward approach. Na'aseh v'nishma. We'll do what we've already heard and prepare to hear all the rest. In presenting or introducing another approach, we really need to ask the question, what is the Sefer HaBris? Pasuk Zion refers, Vayikra Sefer HaBris, the Torah doesn't identify what the Sefer HaBris is, but it does mention it. What is the Sefer HaBris? I mean, what Sefer exists at this stage? So here we have a well-known machlokas, Rashi and Ramban. Rashi maintains that the Sefer HaBris is basically the Chumash from the beginning until this point, which is quite a lot. Chumash Brachos and half of Chumash Shemos. It's already happened. Moshe has already received it. Having happened, Moshe can receive it as a Sefer, which he does. And that's the Sefer HaBris according to Rashi, from Brachos until Parshas Yisro. The Ramban, on the other hand, understands that the Sefer HaBris is from Aseret HaDibros till the end of Mishpatim. Okay, that's the Sefer HaBris. To say they've already come to Sinai, they've heard Aseret HaDibros, and it keeps going. And again, that's Ramban, consistent with his understanding that the Psukim are Keseder, so this whole thing happens after Mishpatim. So that's the Sefer HaBris. But what's very interesting is, there is a third opinion as to what the Sefer HaBris is. And it's the Ibn Ezra, and although it seems like the Ibn Ezra, who's capable of saying whatever he feels is the pshat, the source of the Ibn Ezra is actually sourced in the Mechilta, as a precedent in the Mechilta. Says Ibn Ezra, you know what the Sefer HaBris is? It's the parshas of Bahar and Bechukosai. Should you say to me, Bahar and Bechukosai, I mean, that's at the end of Vayikra. How is that the Sefer HaBris? Well, actually, as true as it is, for whatever reasons, and they need to be discussed themselves, they are the end of Vayikra, but isn't it interesting that they are very emphatically introduced as being from Har Sinai? Bahar begins, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Bahar Sinai Leimor, B'chukosai ends, Eile Divrei HaBris, or Eile Mitzvot Asher Dibre Moshe, Bahar Sinai. And again, it's a rather extreme case of Ein Muktam Me'uchar, right, for various other reasons, the Torah at the end of Vayikra, but they are the Sefer HaBris. Very interesting. And by the way, they sound like the Sefer HaBris. They're terms and conditions. B'chukosai, B'chukosai Teleichu, B'chukosai Timotu. So that's the third understanding of Sefer HaBris, the Parshas of Bahar, and the Parshas of B'chukosai. Says Rabbi Velvo Soloveitchik. He has a chush in Parshanut, which is incredible. If, according to the Mechilta, which then becomes the Ibn Ezra, the Sefer HaBris is Bahar B'chukosai, we can understand very well why the Bnei Yisrael responded to the Sefer HaBris with the words, Nase V'nishma. Why? Because if you look at the Parshas of Bahar and B'chukosai, you will see that they are rather different from each other. Parshas Bahar contains mitzvahs. Shemitah, halachos of buying and selling land in Eretz Yisrael, mitzvahs. B'chukosai contains the tochacha, warning, terms and conditions. That's not a mitzvah. You just need to know it. And therefore, if the Sefer HaBris is Bahar B'chukosai, so then the response to rehearing the Sefer HaBris is absolutely, the positive response is, Nase V'nishma. Why? Nase for Parshas Bahar and V'nishma for Parshas B'chukosai. Parshas Bahar contains mitzvahs. The response to being given a mitzvah is to say, we'll do it. The response to being given a tochacha is to say, we accept it. We hear it. And therefore, Nase V'nishma is, those are the two words that really encapsulate the response to Bahar and B'chukosai, respectively. Dvarim Niflaim. And as a final offering for the understanding of Nase V'nishma, the Beis HaLevi, in his introduction to the Beis HaLevi, on the Torah, let's say, he quotes the Zohar HaKadosh. And the Zohar says, that makes the following comment on Naaseh V'nishma. Naaseh, we will do, says the Zohar, Be'ovdin Tavin. Ovdin Tavin, Maasim Tovim, good deeds. V'nishma, and we will hear, Be'piskomin De'oraisa, with Divrei Torah. What does this come to mean? Says the Beis HaLevi, what it means is that here we're being told about what it means to learn Torah. What are Divrei Torah? As if to say, the notion that we may have is that the subtotal of the value of words of Torah is that when you know Torah, you're then able to do mitzvahs. They are the instructions for keeping mitzvahs. However, as we know from so many places, that is not the be-all and end-all of learning Torah at all. Rather, learning Torah, of course, is very necessary to get you to be able to do mitzvahs. Lo ama aretz chassid, ein bo yirechet. If you don't know, you can't do. However, the value of learning Torah exists per se as an enterprise in its own right. It's its own mitzvah. But the only way that comes out is by putting nishma after naaseh. It changes the way Talmud Torah is understood. Because had it said first Nishma and then Naaseh, it would give the implication that the hearing Divrei Torah is only as a means to get you to Naaseh. But Nishma is so much more. It is all that and more. On the one hand, Naaseh, which must incorporate knowing Torah in order to do it, but even when you know, there's still Nishma, there's still Divrei Torah for their own sake. Torah Lishma. And in fact, says the Beis HaLevi, so important is this appreciation of Talmud Torah, important for each and every person. But to see how it expresses itself, the Gemara famously asks, Alma avda ha'aretz, what was the root cause of the land being lost, of the destruction of the Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael on the first Beis HaMikdash? And the answer that the Gemara cryptically gives is Lo berchu b'Torah tchila. They didn't make a bracha before they learned Torah. And if we ask, what does that mean? They missed a bracha, but what does that represent? What it represents is, says Beis HaLevi, you know, brachas we make for mitzvahs. If you're just preparing to do a mitzvah, you don't make a bracha. When you build a sukkah, you don't make a bracha, because you're building the sukkah, but the mitzvah is to be in the sukkah. That's when you make the bracha. When you're baking a matzah, you don't make a bracha, because the baking is a preparation towards the eating. The mitzvah is the eating, that's when you make the bracha. Therefore, what was so sorely lacking for the Jewish people at that time is that it seems like they were learning, but they didn't make a bracha before they learned. And what does that reflect? It reflects the fact they didn't appreciate learning Torah as an actual mitzvah, but rather we learn because we need to know how to do mitzvahs. Without that, all of the wondrous protective powers of Torah and everything that... You don't have it, because if you don't appreciate Torah fully for what it is, you're not able to reap the dividends of what Torah can give you. And that is a very striking, because it turns out that this appreciation of learning Torah as an end in itself, as a goal in itself, as the ultimate mitzvah, was embedded from the beginning of Naaseh v'Nishma and had disastrous consequences when it was missing, which all the more behooves us to be sure to be fully conscious of it, fully appreciative of it, as we go about our Torah, not only with Ma'asim Tovim, the Torah at least Ma'asim Tovim, but also beyond that, with Piskomin, De'oraisa, Naaseh, and Nishma. We'll leave it over there.